Previously on Forever Chemicals.
We learned how far the outdoor industry was behind in phasing out PFAS in production, and who some of the big players have been in the continued pollution of PFAS in the United States.
If I start with what is PFAS? PFAS is a very big group of fluororganic chemicals and polymers. They have what we call extraordinary properties.
PFAS are industrial chemicals, and the carbon-fluorine bond is perhaps the strongest in the periodic table. It takes the energy of lightning to break it.
PFAS are known as forever chemicals.
The chemical industry knew that PFAS could be harmful.
But it's used in places that folks don't think. It's in every pizza box that you've gotten a pizza in. It's in your coffee cup at your favorite coffee joint around the corner. It's in cosmetics. You know, it's everywhere.
PFAS chemicals are wreaking havoc on our health and environment.
It's a really serious issue.
So there's health impacts and there are environmental impacts.
So many of them have been found to last essentially on geologic time.
Difficult to remove, difficult to filter, and then once removed and filtered, difficult to dispose of. They have been found to bioaccumulate in people and animals and have been found in almost every living creature on Earth.
We need to eliminate our apparent appetite for using PFAS.
The environmental impacts are pretty potent. Many of us refer to these as forever chemicals.
I think the outdoor industry is unique in that it produces things that have really high technical performance. They have been involved, deeply involved with suppliers to understand how do you get the best performance from this set of chemistry or this set of materials or, you know, this set of inputs. They're folks who are really connected to their suppliers and understanding what is on the horizon, what are the new materials that are being developed, because that's the demand. From a market perspective, people who are going outside, they want the best. They want the best protection. They want to be able to go out there in extreme conditions and thrive and enjoy themselves safely. So I think the outdoor industry is uniquely positioned in really understanding the inputs in their products. The challenge is that PFAS have been so useful for this product set, and that unique position of understanding the inputs and being reliant on this chemistry, it's a challenging place to be.
I would say it took the outdoor industry a really long time to recognize that PFAS was a problem. I don't think they recognized it until California banned PFAS from textiles, and then they recognized it because they had to.
It seems as though PFAS has become a regular part of the conversation among brands, at trade shows, outdoor conferences, and in the media within the last few years. After the media frenzy surrounding the initial DuPont lawsuit, there was widespread knowledge of the dangers of PFAS. So what happened between now and then? Why wasn't the outdoor industry a leader in this space when science has been public knowledge for over a decade?
My name's Kevin Mayette. I'm the Global Director for Brand Services for Bluesign Technologies. I help our system partner brands to be their best on many things, but primarily in this area of chemical integrity and generally in sustainability. First of all, I've never been a huge fan of regulation because oftentimes it is a low bar for some of the things we want to do. And it's not a leading indicator, it's a trailing indicator. However, in the case of PFAS, I have changed my tune a little bit. I believe that, you know, we've been on this journey. We, the industry, the outdoor industry, have been on this journey towards removing PFAS. For a long time, I mentioned to you before, I got questions back in the year 1998 or 95 or so when I was at REI about PFCs in product and didn't have much to tell them at that time, only that we were aware of it and we try to minimize its use it when it's necessary, et cetera, et cetera. But it was very much legal. So there was a lot of work that happened in the outdoor industry to actually address these challenges. In fact, some of the work under the OIA has been really very instrumental in creating the market for alternatives to PFAS and driving that. And some of the collaboration was super helpful in making that happen. However, we still didn't move fast enough. And again, we're talking not a matter of a year, we're talking years and decades of kind of doing the status quo. The challenge with PFAS, and particularly on DWR, is this level of performance. We had an incredibly high degree of performance, of which our industry is based on performance. We had an easy to use chemistry, generally easy to use than the alternatives, and it was less expensive. And so we had this, you know, triple threat of why there wasn't enough momentum in moving away from it. So regulation, what it did is it finally kicked us in the fanny. I would say two things did. One is regulation, but the second was the work of Greenpeace. And as much as I, you know, sit here and not sure I want to admit that, but it was great when Greenpeace said, hey, outdoor industry, you know, chemistry for any weather. They wrote that report, and it was a real driver for getting the work to happen. Now, the good news is the outdoor industry is very good at collaborating, because if we all tried to solve this PFAS problem on our own, we would never have gotten there. And, you know, arguably one of our challenges is going to be performance. We're going to have to be really clear as to where the highest level of performance is going to be. And it's going to be really hard to match that performance that we used to have.
Performance for the outdoor industry may have been the driving factor behind even big brands like Patagonia dragging their feet, but what about the rest of the manufacturing world? When it comes to the regulation of harmful chemicals like PFAS, there's always going to be pushback from the chemical industry, and even corruption with regulatory bodies like the Environmental Protection Agency that muddle the waters, making it even more difficult to understand how to get from point A to point B. In preparing for this podcast, I attended a webinar hosted by the Food and Water Watch describing the complexity of the PFAS problem and the challenges they've faced pushing for regulations. During the webinar, guest speaker Kyla Bennett, Director of Science Policy at Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, overviewed the EPA's proposal to regulate PFAS in the United States.
EPA's Office of Water in March of this year proposed what we call MCLs, maximum contaminant levels, which is actually limits, regulatory enforceable limits for the amount of PFAS that you can have in drinking water. Unfortunately, they only are proposing to regulate 6 PFAS. And remember, there are 14,000 or more. So 6 is really a drop in the bucket. But they are proposing fairly low limits for PFOA and PFOS, those two really dangerous ones. They're proposing 4 parts per trillion of each as a level in your drinking water. And then they're also proposing to regulate another 4 with something they call a hazard index, which isn't a concentration. It's an algebraic equation that you have to do based on what they think the toxicity of these other 4 PFAS are. And those PFAS are Gen X, which was supposedly the safer replacement for PFOA, but it's not safer. It may actually be more dangerous than PFOA. PFBS, PFNA, and PFHXS. So they're proposing to regulate 6. The first 2, as I said, PFOA and PFOS, with a 4 part per trillion limit. It's important to note that in their proposed rule, they have a MCLG, which is a maximum contaminant level goal of 0 for these chemicals. And they actually say in the rule that there is no safe dose of PFOA and PFOS in drinking water. Just like lead, there's literally no safe dose of these. The reason they are setting the limit at 4 parts per trillion is because there are a lot of labs that have difficulty measuring amounts below that because it's such a tiny amount. But when you think about it, the reason this is so concerning is that these minute amounts of chemical are dangerous. And so therefore, EPA is seeking a 0 amount. Now, is it enough? Absolutely not. What EPA really needs to do is define PFAS broadly. Right now, there isn't even a consistent definition of PFAS at EPA. And unless you can define something, you can't regulate it. So we have disparate definitions, even within the same agency, between the states and the federal government, between different agencies in the federal government. EPA needs to define them broadly, regulate them as a class, and ban all non-essential uses, which is most of them. I mean, we don't need PFAS in our mascara. I mean, that's a convenience, not a necessity. Are there essential uses? Maybe. Some medicines like Paxlovid is a PFAS. Prozac is a PFAS. Some medical devices have PFAS in them. So there might be some essential uses that we need to hold on to for now until we can find a safer alternative. But basically, that's what EPA needs to do: define them broadly, regulate them as a class, and ban all non-essential uses.
Following Kyla Bennett's remarks on the EPA's regulation of PFAS in recent years, researcher Natalie Balbuena spoke on some of the limitations of these regulations and the influence of the chemical industry.
Kyla touched on one of the big key things, which is, you know, failing to define PFAS. It's a huge class of over 12,000 chemicals. We need a way to categorize what we actually need to use and what we don't need to use for the sake of saving a couple profit margins or whatever. The other large part is the actual failure of information that we have at disposal to us. This is partially because we found out very late in the game, you know, since the early 2000s, the public was aware of that this was a thing that we needed to look for. And the thing to think about is, how do you test or how do you protect yourself against something that you don't even know what you're protecting yourself against and what levels and where it is? And there hasn't been any nationwide efforts to really like collect a lot of data until recently, with the recent passing of the US CMR 5, which is nationwide testing protocol that the EPA gives out. It's done across a certain number of years. And recently they named PFAS. I think it was about, of the however many they proposed, a majority of them were PFAS to be tested. So that will hopefully bring up some more information that we can work off of. And then the other big thing is really like just the influence of the chemical industry in general, both in their tactics to control the narrative, you know, distort the public disclosure, distort the information they have, and in general, like just lobbying as well. A lot of influence of the chemical industry has in fact impacted the way a lot of organizations have run their protocols when it comes to regulating these chemicals. A lot of whistleblowers may speak to that. There's been a lot of documented interference in these kinds of things. The Trump administration had somebody modify a toxicity assessment. Other officials at research agencies were told to modify certain words when it came to PFAS. So there's just a lot of influence there. I think up until now, you know, no one knew about PFAS, so they had all these other tactics to resort to. But now, up until recently, we found that lawmakers have been really focusing on pushing out PFAS legislation. And so with that, you come and introduce this new tactic, you know, lobbying and using money for things. And so with that, we found that analyzing a certain period that basically ran parallel to the rate at which those bills are being introduced, we found that a lot of PFAS producers, the major ones that are current top PFAS producers, as well as some historical ones that came up in the report, such as DuPont, that they used over $55 million to lobby these things, alongside the ACC, which used $58 million. And that's just really like the PFAS industry as a whole. PFAS is a thing that impacts everybody. It's a thing that impacts most industries, even if they intentionally use it or not. And so in some cases, we found that there were links directly to the oil and gas industry, that they use PFAS in their fracking fluids. And we found that they were present in like lobbying PFAS-related bills. Their total came up to $67 million. Additionally, like again, with the whole multi-industry influence here, there was a coalition that we found that was headed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that was made up of these industries. We had paper, we had plastics, we had textile, and they were taking a definite stance against the regulation of PFAS as a hazardous substance. And in total, they lobbied PFAS-related bills up to around $317 million. And so even though lots of bills were introduced, like over 100, only two standalone bills became law amongst all of those. And I think a lot of the lobbying receipts, while they're not necessarily direct, lobbying receipts will never tell you directly which amounts go to where and how much. They kind of just give you a summary, a total each quarter. They kind of tell us the activity that these companies, these industries were trying to throw their money at, essentially. And unfortunately, a lot of great bills did die in a lot of these sessions. Of the few that actually managed to move forward in any way, the PFAS Action Act, which had different versions passed or trying to be passed in different years, was a very comprehensive one. And, you know, as a result, a lot of people in the PFAS supportive sector feared it. And so they threw a lot at it. They threw a lot of money. They threw a lot of lobbyists. They put in a lot of effort towards it. And even though it passed House, it ended up dying in a Senate committee, which again poses kind of an even more of a concern, because we looked at that Senate committee, the Senate committee which that bill, that really great bill, went to, and we found that 13 out of 19 of those members received campaign contributions from all of the companies and industries that we had looked at during that time frame, 2019 to 2022. And I mean, that really doesn't bode well for any future legislation that manages to even scrape by and pass the House. You know, there's a lot of things here that tell us just how much influence the industry has with its money.
I think it's important to point out that it's not just lobbyists that are trying to get EPA to define PFAS really narrowly, but it's also the Department of Defense, because the Department of Defense is a sister agency, if you will, to EPA, but they are one of the biggest polluters in this country, in the world. The US DOD is one of the biggest polluters in the world, and they are responsible for a lot of PFAS contamination. So they have been lobbying very hard to make EPA, first of all, define PFAS narrowly, but also to keep the levels, the proposed regulatory limits, high, because they don't want to be burdened with the cost of cleanup of all of the Department of Defense facilities across the country, let alone the world. So it's not just the lobbyists, but it's also other federal agencies that are responsible. So the one bill, the Superfund bill, which is CERCLA, everyone knows it as Superfund, which is one of EPA's really successful bills. It's slow, but it's successful. And it basically is a strict liability statute, which requires polluters to pay for land that they've polluted. And there's a big effort in Congress to exempt certain industry from this proposed law, which EPA wants, which would add PFOA and PFOS, just two PFAS, to the Superfund cleanup standards. And they want to exempt Department of Defense facilities, airports, farmers, because of biosolids, which is a whole other issue that I won't take a lot of time of. But just so you're aware, biosolids is just a euphemism for sewage sludge, human sewage sludge. And when our waste goes into a sewer system and goes to a wastewater treatment plant, the wastewater treatment plant is left with all of this stuff after it's allegedly cleaned. And what EPA proposed years ago is, let's take some of the water out, dry it up, and then we'll have a great fertilizer and people can put it on crops and it'll be a great cheap fertilizer and we'll take care of the problem of where do we put all this stuff. Turns out that the biosolids or the sewage sludge has a ton of PFAS in it. And farmers all across the country have been applying the sewage sludge to their farms and their fields, and it is contaminating their soil, it's contaminating the crops that they grow, and it's contaminating the animals that are eating those crops, to the point where farms in Michigan, in Maine, in New Mexico, all over the country have had to shut down because their milk and their meat have so much PFAS that it's not safe for people to consume. But to get back to the Superfund law, by trying to exempt these certain categories of potential polluters, the problem is that it will disincentivize people from trying to stop using PFAS. I mean, the whole solution here is to turn off the tap of PFAS contamination. We have to stop putting PFAS in products. And if we start exempting airports and farmers and wastewater treatment facilities from these laws, then what's going to happen is nobody's going to have the incentive to try to stop putting PFAS in there in the first place. And we have to keep in mind that EPA has very, very broad enforcement discretion. So EPA has a hard time going after the worst violators. They're not going to go after farmers. They can use their discretion to say, this farmer was innocent. They had no idea that the biosolids that they're spreading on their fields contained PFAS, and it's not their fault, and they shouldn't have to pay for it, which is the truth. They are not going to enforce against those people. So we really feel very strongly that they should not start exempting certain industries from regulating PFAS under Superfund, because other industries are going to start clamoring for it to be exempt as well. So it's going to open the door to something that EPA has never done before, which is exempting certain industries from what is a very powerful strict liability statute. it's not just industry and the American Chemistry Council that's causing all these problems. There is malfeasance in EPA itself. The Office of Pesticide Program and the TSCA program, the Toxic Substances Control Act, the people that do the new chemicals, approve new chemicals to go out in commerce, they're broken. These two programs really need to be raised and built back up from the ground because they have been infiltrated by industry itself. There's a revolving door. So these managers will go work for industry and then come back to EPA and do things that are good for industry and then go back to industry and come back again. For whatever reason, they are actually manipulating data, manipulating math. They are taking scientists' results on how toxic a chemical is and saying, no, just delete that. We don't want to say that. We want to get this chemical out on the market. And if you don't believe me, you should read a very powerful 10-part series written by Sharon Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R, when she was at The Intercept. She's now at ProPublica, but when she was at Intercept, she worked with 5 whistleblowers that were my clients at EPA, and they came with receipts. We have emails and audio recordings and so much evidence of this malfeasance at EPA and this capture by industry of this division in EPA that it's absolutely stunning and very disheartening. And I strongly urge you to read that series if you can.
Since the EPA isn't stepping up to be the main regulatory force regarding PFAS, we have been seeing a shift within individual states in the U.S. to ban certain uses specifically within consumer goods.
Well, the states are trying to fill the regulatory void that EPA has left. So some of the states are doing great work. Maine comes to mind. Maine has some of the best PFAS laws out there right now, which was a little surprising to me, but good for them. New York has some good ones. California is starting. Massachusetts has some really good bills pending. I live in Massachusetts. We regulate 6 PFAS in our drinking water and have since 2020 for 3 years now, almost 4 years. And so the states are defining PFAS broadly and starting to put in bills, not only regulating PFAS in water, but also they're putting out do not eat advisories for fish and deer. They're regulating PFAS in food wrappers. They're regulating PFAS in artificial turf and other consumer products, car seats and carpets and things like that. And when you educate the public, and the public starts pushing back against the companies that are making these products, that works. So for example, IKEA has no PFAS in any of their products. Home Depot and Lowe's, they've taken all the PFAS out of their carpets because it's been in a lot of carpets. So there are companies starting to respond and you can start to get some PFAS-free products. So I think those are some victories that we can take heart from.
There are a number of different regulations going into effect in the next few years. They bucket into a few different categories. One are blanket prohibitions, and we're seeing prohibitions of product categories or the entire scope of consumer products, both being implemented at the state level. Just to give one example, in California and in New York, there will be prohibitions going into effect targeting textiles and apparel. Textiles in California, apparel, a more specific category in New York. Those prohibitions are going to have major implications across the outdoor industry, and we'll see those going into effect within a year. We're also seeing reporting rules going into effect. That's kind of a second category. The state of Maine implemented one of the largest reporting requirements that's been implemented up to this point. Starting January 1st, 2025, to sell any product in the state of Maine containing PFAS, you have to report the amount of PFAS in that product. That's going to create a huge data set of what is being put on market and what does it contain. At the federal level, we're also seeing the development of these kinds of regulations at a somewhat slower clip. One of the largest regulations that was recently finalized, it's under the Toxic Substances Control Act, which tends to regulate the production of chemicals themselves. This is an interesting rulemaking in that it does target actually products more broadly. Articles is what they're described as in the regulation. And it's seeking information on PFAS used in articles imported into the US from 2011 to 2022. It's going to create one of the largest data sets that we've ever had about PFAS in consumer products. And EPA plans to make large portions of the submissions public. So this could be a huge data set that can be used by regulators, by consumers, by any number of entities that are interested in understanding what are these historical PFAS inputs into the economy.
I would say that California was probably the first and is now the wedge driving a lot of this because there wasn't any other legislation in place that was effective before. There was some legislation in the state of Maine around reporting for this, but there was a delay. You could apply for an exception. The reporting mechanisms weren't, I'm not a lawyer, the reporting mechanisms were not in place. So there were people working on that one, but I don't think that it was driving change per se. The California legislation now has several other states that have joined it in either scope, language, or timing, or some combination thereof. I think what the California one also had that some others hadn't yet, in terms of apparel, other categories and product classifications did, they were rather clear. It's a ban. Here's how we want to measure it, and here's when it takes effect. I want to be really careful here. I'll say something that gets me. I have kind of two approaches. I think the last time I used this stat a lot, I should Google it to see if it's true, but I think California is the fifth largest economy in the world, something like that. I mean, in itself, it's massive. So the ability for the state of California to make a decision and cause change globally is great. It's huge. And in that sense, good. They're an ability to create change that is potentially swift. I think that California has a really strong history of legislation in terms of the Prop 65 world and other actions. And Prop 65 actually had some of these PFAS-related chemicals or some of the chemicals listed prior to the ban. So there was some action being spurred through Prop 65 as well, that there's an environment in the state of California for things like this to be banned or large scale classes. For the record, I think they took really bold action that might be too big in terms of driving change. And then the last, in terms of like, we could have been a little more targeted. There could have been a roadmap. There could have been some assessments in terms of safety and health to where maybe we didn't ban the entire product class. We just did other things. I leave that to the experts and the lawyers and everybody else. But the other thing I like to say pretty often is that people who will benefit from this ban first are not the citizens of California. It's the people who work in our production spaces, our supply chain, our factories. I have friends. I've been in rooms where this is applied. I was in a room with this being dumped in just months ago. They're the people who will benefit from this first. And in most cases, people start to freak out about, oh my gosh, my rain jacket is going to cause me harm. I'll just say that. I don't know. I haven't really been presented yet with really clear evidence that a jacket in its solid polymerized, fully functional form causes cancer. I do know the chemicals are pretty harmful to humans. And if you're standing over a machine dumping blue barrels in 6 days a week for your entire life, there's definitely some bad effects to that. So I think that's where a full-blown ban of PFAS in firefighting foams, in coffee cups, in pizza boxes. Okay, good links. I see that. In this particular area, I struggle a little bit with how quickly this impacts health and human safety in these products. Probably should also say we operate a selling facility in California. We make products for the US government and allied DOD related forces. So certainly there is some exceptions and some supply chain challenges for us in exception-based areas where we will continue to use some PFAS contractually with the US government, federal government, not state of California government. That's one of those areas where this is really mercurial is the word I think I would use.
For companies that are not proactively managing PFAS risks, we're beginning to see class action lawsuits filed against companies that claim their products are environmentally friendly yet are laden with PFAS. We're also seeing more and more governments around the US and around the world enact policies to ban PFAS in products like apparel. The states of California and New York and Washington have enacted policies restricting PFAS in apparel. So this is a trend that's not going to go away. And companies that are not leading on this issue not only face regulatory liabilities and legal risks, but they also face reputational risks for selling products that most people don't want to support. While many of us appreciate some of the benefits that PFAS can afford, such as stain or water resistance, the good news is that we're seeing many companies develop new innovative technologies. I think that the laws and policies that we're seeing in states like Washington, New York, California, Minnesota, Maine are going to have a big effect in not only driving PFAS out of apparel, but many other types of products where PFAS can be found. One of the challenges, though, is that how do we know the alternatives are actually truly safer for not only consumers, but for communities, workers, and the larger environment?
While it seems that the U.S. regulations are pushing outdoor brands to make changes, these are still falling at a state level, not a federal level. There's not one standard for PFAS regulation in the U.S., and there definitely isn't a standard for PFAS use in the production around the world.
In the European Union, we have the restrictions on, of course, since many years on PFOS and related substances, since a bit more than 10 years. We had a few years ago a restriction on PFOA, the C8 chemistry. That is now listed in the Stock Convention also, beside PFOS. And we have this soon restriction on the so-called C6 chemistry. It will probably be decided next year with very few exemptions. And then we have this broader PFAS restriction that will wipe out 95% of the PFAS use in the European Union. So this is very broad. That includes fluoropolymers, which is not the case in many parts. Sorry for saying this, with all respect, in the United States. But maybe you come someday and do that. I don't know. But in Canada, they are more, as far as I know, CEPA, the Canadian US EPA. They have all this environmental approach that you have to register and prioritize certain chemicals, groups of chemicals. And so far, I understand that they are very much focused on what's going on in the Stockholm Convention, where the listing and phasing out of PFAS is accelerating. Canada proposed, I think 2 years ago, to phase out longer chain PFAS from C9 to C21. And that is where Canada is a rapporteur. So they're very active, but I haven't heard that much about their work on the consumer market. I'm a bit uncertain, very high focus on the environmental concern, which is absolutely okay. But this is the approach from the Canadian legislation. And you have to some extent similar to the US legislation that you have to register and approve chemicals before they can enter that market. You have a mechanism here. The Stock Convention is global. And what those PFAS or other chemicals, POP, persistent organic pollutants, that are listed in the Stock Convention, go right into what we call the EU POP regulation. That is a mirror of the Stock Convention on the European level.
European POP regulation stands for persistent organic pollutants.
Other PFAS that are not listed are going into the REACH regulation.
REACH is a European regulation that is an acronym for Registration, Evaluation, Authorization, and Restriction of Chemicals. The overall aim of REACH is to provide a high level of protection of human health and the environment from the use of chemicals.
So we have two chemical frameworks that restrict hazardous chemicals. If you have a chemical that is already restricted in the REACH regulation, that's the framework of the restrictions in the European Union. Around 2,000 various chemicals restricted, and the registration. There are several steps in the REACH regulation. The first, you need a license, a green card, to use a chemical in the European Union. And that's called the registration process. And 143,000 chemicals are registered today. They have to report the importer or the producer, a lot of data, tox data, environmental impact data, etc. And from that data, which is not always the best quality, the regulators look into that, the authorities, and see which chemicals are of certain concern, and there are further processes. So if these chemicals are, if there is enough evidence, enough thresholds to restrict these chemicals because they pose an unacceptable risk during normal use, and they are not in the Stock Convention, they are in the REACH regulation. If they are listed in the Stock Convention, which happens almost the same time because the European Union is sponsoring a lot of work in the Stock Convention, so it goes into this new POP regulation. But if a chemical is already restricted in the REACH regulation and listed afterwards in the Stock Convention, it jumps over to the POP regulation. There was an example with PFOA. It's listed in SOC, but that happened after it was restricted in the REACH regulation. And some reactions from the industry are, oh, PFOA is gone. No, it's not. It jumped over to that regulation. So they thought, oh, it's a free card. We can do whatever we want with PFOA because it's not there anymore. No, but it's there. It's there. It jumped like 10 meters to the right. And I think most companies, at least those working the core of the companies with chemical management and regulatory issues, they are aware of this. So this regulation, these restriction proposals I talked about are most likely going into the REACH regulation. And that will impact trade in other parts of the world. Of course, the European Union will market, not market in the ordinary sense, in the convention that we have enough evidence, we see quite a lot of evidence needed to restrict chemicals. And they will, of course, promote this work in the Stockholm Convention. We will do that, of course. Yes.
The Stockholm Convention and European Union REACH and POP regulations have pushed for stricter PFAS regulation and, in some cases, seen success. But there are parts of the world that are seeing more success regulating harmful chemicals than others.
So these are the regions that have a bit more wider regulation, Australia, European Union, and North America than required by the Stockholm Convention.
While it is good to see regulatory bodies taking steps to move in the right direction and pushing the industry away from PFAS, is it enough? Should we rely on regulations to have human and environmental health as a top priority?
So my name is Eva Carlson. I am the CEO and co-founder of Houdini Sportswear. Houdini is a Swedish outdoor brand based in Stockholm. It's been around for 30 years. I'm all for strong, strict regulations, and I believe that the PFAS regulations that are coming into place now in the US and here in Europe as well have a massive effect on the industry. For some companies like ourselves, it's a part of our ethos, so we would do it whether there's a regulation coming or not. But if there's any policymakers listening to this, I would say that regulations are extremely important in order to move towards a sustainable world in general, move towards circular from linear, and phasing out chemistry like PFAS. It's extremely important. And suddenly there's a lot of innovation and there's a lot of enthusiasm even among brands. And it's also a way, of course, to create a level playing field. So extremely positive.
Most of the regulations, both in and out of the United States, seem to focus on cutting off production of PFAS, which is absolutely vital. It would be nice to see a broader definition of PFAS presented within these regulations, but that may come with time. Moving forward, there's also concern about how cleanup of these chemicals fits into regulation and who is responsible for paying for remediation efforts.
To date, many people have become aware of PFAS, and it's a huge regulatory concern. So there's been a lot of sampling and analysis and assessing sites to see if there's PFAS present. There has been very, very little cleanup efforts to date. And the reason for that is everybody is holding their breath and waiting for the US EPA to come up with standards. Right now, there's no federal standard. There are some state standards, but federally regulated airports, federally regulated military bases, these big notorious sites, they don't have cleanup standards to meet because the US EPA has not promulgated any or come up with any decisions on exactly what they're going to need to have as cleanup standards. They proposed very low levels, but they haven't been finalized. So I think a lot of these sites are waiting to know what standards they have to reach, and then they'll move forward with cleanup activities. In the near future, the US EPA is claiming that they will regulate PFOA and PFOS as hazardous substances under the Superfund law. And when that happens, that will be a real call to action. So we think that once that occurs, many of the facilities that are handling PFOS and PFOA in the past, they will step up and have to do something about cleaning up the sites that they've impacted. So not a lot is happening on the cleanup side yet, but I think everybody's waiting for the EPA to make a decision. And once that happens, I think that there will be a lot of cleanups. I think that as we move forward and the regulations actually come out for cleanup, I think that we're going to find that there's more sites than we know of now that will need cleanup. and that people will be moving to treat it in place below the earth. The way that we work here in the U.S. is that once the U.S. EPA promulgates standards, the states have to follow with equal or more stringent. So once they set the bar, the rest of the nation will have to follow.
What I would recommend is that we figure out a constructive way of handling this problem, because it may not be the last time that humanity has been forced to deal with this, where an industrial production, perhaps over decades, has generated environmental contamination. And it may be at apparently low concentrations, but the compound may be particularly dangerous, so that even what we think is a low concentration is still hazardous to human health. We need to develop a way to make sure that industrial compounds are not just developing some new chemicals that appear to be absolutely fantastic for their purposes without taking into regard the environment or human health. And we also need to develop methods, and it may include legal mechanisms to ensure that everything is cleaned up. If, unfortunately, this accident may happen, that the chemicals are disseminated into the environment. And this could also involve train accidents that we saw in New Palestine. I mean, there are many ways that these chemicals can enter the environment and result in human exposures. We have been incautious in our procedure of making sure that we're not doing something that can cause human harm. And with the PFASs, we know that the harm is particularly being borne by the next generation. And we've created enough problems for the next generation. We are also exposing fetuses and small children to compounds like certain pesticides or solvents, whatever they are, that adversely affect brain development. And if there's anything that the next generation cannot afford, that is a loss of IQ, because they needed to deal with climate change and all the other problems that we have forced them to inherit.
The regulation of PFAS chemicals has become more commonplace in parts of the world like Europe, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, but we still have a long way to go. In the next episode, we'll hear directly from the outdoor industry brands that chose to never include PFAS in their production. If you want to learn more about what PFAS are, where they're found, the proven health effects, how you can limit your exposure, up-to-date news on PFAS, and how to get involved in PFAS regulatory efforts, visit ToxicFreeFuture.org, FoodAndWaterWatch.org, or PFASCentral.org. SnapLink Consulting provided expert fact-checking and guidance for the creation of this podcast. SnapLink Consulting provides corporate sustainability strategies and ESG support across a broad range of industries, including apparel, footwear, home furnishings, software, cosmetics, professional services, and more. Head to snaplinkconsulting.com to learn more and contact the experts to guide you through complex topics like CSRD, PFAS, greenhouse gas assessments, SBTI, CDP, EcoVadis, B Corp, and many more compliance and certification frameworks. Forever Chemicals is a Black-Footed Ferret production. All the source material for this episode can be found in the show notes or at theoutdoorminimalist.com/foreverchemicals. As an independent podcast, we rely on listener support as our primary avenue for funding. If you like this show and our other content, consider donating to our GoFundMe. The link is in the show notes.